Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have a very special guest, Gordon T. Long. He's the co-founder of the Financial Repression Authority. He and I started it up. He has been publicly offering his financial and economic writing since 2010, following a career internationally in technology, senior management, and investment finance. He brings a unique perspective to macroeconomic analysis because of his broad background, which is not typically found or available to the public. Gord was senior group executive with IBM and Motorola for over 20 years, and he founded the LCM Group in Paris, France, to specialize in the rapidly emerging internet venture capital and private equity industry. He's a graduate engineer, University of Waterloo, Canada, with graduate business studies at the prestigious business school, University of Western Ontario, Canada. Welcome, Gord.
Well, thank you, Richard. That's the Ivy School down at UWO.
Yeah, great background, and just in all areas to give you that deep insight from different perspectives as you've always had.
Well, thank you, but it makes me feel like I'm an awfully old man. But I am. I'm pretty gray right now. But, Richard, it's nice to be on this end of the of speaker because of all the videos we did for FRA together, videos versus the podcast you're now currently doing. So it's nice to be talking from this end.
Yeah, you've done an incredible number of the videos that we started off with over many years. So with that, today we'll take a look at the 2018 perspective. Over the last several years, you've done a yearly analysis of what the risks are in the economy and the financial markets and put it all together, tying all the dots together in a sort of thesis that you see happening. And you've graciously provided a number of slides which we'll make available also on the website as part of the transcript we will write for this podcast. And so I thought we'd begin there, using that as the basis of our discussion. The first slide, you illustrate a number of risks. Do you want to elaborate on those?
Yeah, absolutely, Richard. As you said, I've been doing these every year. For at least I started in 2010 where I actually started circulating it to my subscribers and into the public domain. And it's not where I choose a subject to write about. It starts with a process I refer to as the process of abstraction. And the first part of that process is listing all of the tipping points that need to be tracked and watched without drawing any conclusions. And the first chart we're showing here, showing the risks, which are grouped in from high to low risk in the various segments here. We had just over 34 last year, which are some of them shown right here on this chart. This year going in, we have 44 that we are following and tracking very closely. And then we take those risks and we start to follow them in a process of abstraction, which I'll show you how we come up with, the thesis. But over on the right-hand side of this chart, you'll notice a red box with 11, and that's the new ones. That's of the 44. This is the top 11, and some quite a number of them have been there for a year, some of them for a couple years now. You know, the bond bubble, China's hard landing, Japan's deflation. But what's really showing up this year and has moved up into this hierarchy is the stock market valuations you see at number two as a tipping point. It hasn't been up this high before, just maybe barely breaking the top 10 as it's grown. But also down at number 11, flows in liquidity. And that is the magnitude of what the normalization by the Federal Reserve, effectively the taper program at the ECB, and even the reductions in the rate of growth of money supply at the Bank of Japan. The flows liquidity, which is still very high at $135 billion a month, is falling and is planned and is mapped out to fall. So these are some of the destabilizing factors that we see growing. Not that the others here aren't going away. And another one, too, is number eight, credit contraction. We are at the end of an extended expansionary period, one of the longest in history. We're going into our ninth year, and we see signals that the business cycle and credit cycle has changed, has reversed, and is starting to fall off. So, you know, with that as backdrop, the second chart here, Richard, is really the process we flow. So you see the colored boxes on the left, and then we start to abstract those and group them into themes. And then from those themes, we try and synthesize them to say, what are they trying to tell us? And you can, as we move to the right, and at the bottom, you can see the kinds of things we track over at a site I have with my son, called MATASII.com, and we track all those, and they're in the public domain if you want to follow them or look at them. But it leads to these conclusions, and that is the subject. And you can see where it's led us in previous years as they keep shifting around, and the thesis papers that we wrote. And, you know, what we find, too, is we're always at least about 18 months to 2 years ahead of things before they really come into the fray and become, you know, major front and center. You see, when you clearly recognize, Richard, is financial repression back in 2012. It was pointing us earlier, 2 years before that, that was going to be a major movement, and that was as quantitative easing was starting to unfold in the United States. But this year, it's forced us to talk about something called the New World Order. And that is, and I need to state right off the bat, Richard, that is not something that the conspiracy buffs have been talking about for years. That just happens to be the same name.
Right.
But the New World Order is the change. It's basically a social change that's happening right now because of the advent of networking and networking communications, because of the degree of inequality that's starting to surface across the developed world. The rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, and a number of other factors that we'll get into. But it's changing the forms of governance. It's going to change the forms of institutions that haven't changed since the Bretton Woods at the end of the Second World War, which were predominantly U.S.-based institutions, if you would, IMF, World Bank, or in Washington, though they're global, the United Nations in New York. But these institutions haven't really changed, and the New World is going to force those changes. Governance, the whole idea of the sovereign state, sovereignty, is changing. And so in the paper, we kind of lay out what those changes are going to look like and how they will unfold.
Does this,
any questions on that, Richard?
Yeah. Does this include also sort of the network for blockchain technology and cryptocurrencies?
Yeah, without question. And it's really very central, because one of the major changes is, we believe, is going to be, I won't use the word banking, but in exchange and trading around the world. And I'm not proposing that people should go out and buy Bitcoin, but I am saying that it and other factors like that are going to be with us in a massive way. And maybe more importantly, the technology underlying out of blockchain technology. And so it's going to and is already reinventing banking, and you'll see that accelerating in a bigger way, because it's a reflective that the sovereign state and borders are going away. Once you're on the network, that's the beauty of a product like Bitcoin. And how many are there now? 1,000 different types now.
Yeah.
Last I count, there was 100, but there's all sorts besides Bitcoin. But it says you can go anywhere in the world and do these transactions. So how do you police it? How do you tax it? How do you control it? How do you regulate it? Well, that's the whole beauty of it. It's self-regulating. It's self-policed. You don't need governments. You don't have the costs that go with it. And that's the model. And I'm not trying to talk about Bitcoin. I'm talking about the blockchain and that model.
Yes.
It's one of the driving forces that's going to allow us to really do away in some ways with a nation state. And it doesn't mean we're getting rid of governance, but the governance of populations is going to change. We have a centralized approach to government. It's top down, right? Well, our forefathers never designed it that way. You know, at least in the United States, it was supposed to be the bottom up, the town all the way up to the top, but it's changed. And the technology and the network will allow that to reverse and bring the control down to the bottom. As slowly, because it's not like the status quo is suddenly going to roll over. But these social changes are so big and so powerful, and there will be some crisis in here that will force this change to happen.
Now, on one of the slides you have, the network is the instrument to control governments, or the governments will use it to control us. Which way do you think it'll go, or do you think it'll be a combination of both?
It'll be a war, that's for sure.
Okay.
Because the governments are going to see it as taking away their power and their control. And I don't mean that negatively, because they feel they need to have it to be able to manage. But the reality is that they can be managed differently. And you mentioned in the intro that I had 20 years in corporate life, and so I was well acquainted with trying to run large-scale organizations and we on a global basis. And back in the 80s, the corporations were called international, and they were just really beginning to grow at a growth in the international was far bigger than domestic, and the problems that went with trying to do that. And what came out of it with technology is we had to decentralize. We were forced to decentralize and push it to the lowest level. It allowed us to downsize, right size, outsource, but to flatten organizations so that we could be more responsive and we could operate in more countries effectively. I'm kind of netting that out. Well, the governments are actually in the same boat today. They need to be decentralized, but you can't decentralize over a border. Though you can decentralize in the United States by pushing it down to more control and more power to the towns, but it's going to be across borders. And we're seeing that in effectively trade blocks today. That is where they're trying to work together in a coordinated fashion, is where they're trying to decentralize and have the power of a group. But they haven't harnessed the technology to do it. And that's going to be a big part of the changes of how they do it. So, you know, from a sovereignty standpoint, we're going to go from right now it's top down. We're going to go to bottoms up. You know, we've got inequality between nations within nations. What we're going to have is we're going to have equality across nations. These are some of the changes that are going to start to see. Where we have country laws right now, we're going to see international laws. Because, Richard, globalization was never planned. It happened. And consequently, we've never put institutions, laws in place to handle that. Yes, we have the international courts. And yes, we have the United Nations. But they're not proactive. And as Ronald Reagan said, the government isn't the solution, the government's the problem. And so they're standing in the way of the degree and the speed of which change must happen right now.
Yeah, I can see the power of blockchain technology as providing a decentralized platform to address some of those challenges of inequality, you know, by eliminating the middleman, for example, in transactions or services. But what about on cryptocurrency as one of the applications of blockchain? Do you think that governments will allow private-based cryptocurrencies to coexist with the monopoly power of fiat money that they have today?
Depends on what government you're referring to. Think of it this way. We have, everybody, I think our listeners are aware of the SWIFT system. We really have two sets of governments in the world. We have the developed countries, and then we have, I'll refer to them simply as the BRICS. So we have Russia, we have China, we have Brazil, we have India. We have countries that are outside of the formal developed countries with their currencies where they're debasing it. That is the developed countries. And so when we, for example, pass sanctions against Russia, the way we impose them is things through the SWIFT system in various forms. Well, obviously, there's a tremendous conflict. And it leads into this whole concept of de-dollarization, which is going to be one of the major changes in the next 24 months, Richard. It's huge. And the whole discussion here we should have is on de-dollarization. But there's a conflict that's going on right now. And the answer out of that is part of the answer is what's going to happen with cryptocurrencies. Because it's a way of getting around the controls that the central banks really have on the creation of money and the value of that money and the debasement of the currencies.
Yes.
And ever since Bernanke came in with his enrich thy neighbor versus beggar thy neighbor, enrich their thy neighbor, and we have rotating debasement. That is, when we stop debasing, the ECB does, the Bank of Japan, and I've often referred to this as the currency cartel, the four currencies of the big debtor nations, the United States, the ECB or the euro, the pound, and the yen. And that's 95% of the currencies that are exchanged in the world, and they're the ones that are the primary debasement. On the other side is what I was referring to as the BRICS. They're not debasing. In some ways they are, but they're actually trying to, in many ways, use more gold backing. So there's a fight that's going on, and cryptocurrencies really brings that to the fore. Now Russia or China would tell you their problem with it is it's allowing money to flee out of China right now as capital flight, right?
Yeah.
As this shakes itself out, we've got such huge geopolitical problem issues that are facing us, but the cryptocurrencies are not going away. I'm not saying that Bitcoin might fail and another one might take its place or some other ones. I'm not saying for one moment that the developed world banks aren't going to endorse it, but by endorsing it, I'm referring to controls and trying to use it as competitive advantages as opposed to it being a free open source product. Kind of like Microsoft. It's proprietary. But if you go and you get Firefox, which is open, or I should say Edge from Microsoft, you go to Firefox, it's open technology, right? Complete, no charge, and it's open, and it's still growing. It's like WikiLeaks, Wikipedia, I meant to say. Maybe it should be said of WikiLeaks, but
okay.
where you're opening it up. And once it's opened up in that Pandora's box, it's you allow all the people in the world to participate in it, in a free democracy.
And
I don't know if I'm making any sense there, Richard.
Oh, yeah,
but
yeah.
This is how powerful the concept and the reality is of blockchain and cryptocurrency, because it takes it down to how you can vote. You can start – and I actually lay out in the thesis paper examples and I links to videos – which I encourage listeners to go and get the links, of people who have shown how you can take this technology and put it into democratic organizations from the ground up that actually can grow itself into a world organization, how voting would happen, how policies would be set, how individuals would participate in it at a town level, a state level, a regional, and we'd use different names, right up through a global basis. Where you get really participative democracy, but it works at a much faster period. I mean, it sounds impossible, but there's some brilliant people that have shown how to do it, just as there was brilliant people that showed how blockchain and cryptocurrencies could work.
And do you see this evolution as being part of a movement towards the fiat currency cycle failure, as one of your slides indicates? Are we going to have a coming currency crisis?
I don't know if we're not already in it, Richard,
okay.
And have been for a while, but yes, absolutely. This chart we have here that's labeled a fiat currency, a failure, really kind of shows how we're evolving. And there's a little star in the middle in the red kind of pointing to whereabouts we are in this cycle. I put out a chart that's included in the thesis paper back at the time of the financial crisis called the fiat currency failure and the cycle that we would go through. And this is a very simplified version of it. But, you know, once you get off sound money, you put yourself on a roadmap that actually nobody's ever retrace themselves from and have always ended in a fiat currency failure. And because that's at that point you've entered a fiat currency. But it starts at the top here on the right with growth and debt. Once you start growing your debt, and as in the case of the United States, when you consume more than you produce and you become a debtor nation, and then all of a sudden your balance of trades out, you have to, there's a lack of savings that's going on. You get stagnant productivity. And what it does is it forces you into a fiat currency, which we did officially in August of 1971. But now what starts to happen is you really get stagnant and falling standards of living, because savings, which are typically in a capitalist system, invested into productive assets, is what in fact improves your standard of living. That's what allows the standard of living to increase. And when that doesn't happen, investment starts to slow. And you get falling CapEx, you get falling velocity of money, and you just had Lacey Hunt on, and he's very, very strong on what the issues with falling velocity of money are. But then it leads to, and we've had it for quite some time, financialization of the economy, which we now have. And when you get the financialization of the economy, all these issues that you and I have talked about for years now associated with financial repression become front and center of the government trying to manage the economy the best that it can do. But it leads to extreme leverage, which we have now, unprecedented degrees of leverage, but it creates policy crisis, fiscal, monetary, public policy, that kind of disruption. That's where we are right now. But before we get to the currency failure, the whole leverage itself has to start correcting. And what happens then is really collapsing collateral values. There's insufficient new savings and insufficient profits, and I'm talking about real profits, that are coming from productive assets that's creating new profits, which is new collateral, new value that underpins our society. And we have $230 trillion worth of debt right now. And you don't have debt, or you don't lend money out without collateral, right, Richard? And mm-hmm. And so what happens is all the money that's been lent out, the collateral has been repledged so many times, something right. called rehythopication right. across the global world within the euro dollar system, that the issue now is a shortage of collateral. Now, if the collateral falls in value, let's say interest rates go up on bonds, which means the bond price goes down, the collateral against those bonds is being reduced, or itself, because what we do in our world right now, and I don't want to get too complex here, is we're making debt an asset. So we're taking bonds and making it an asset, and we're pledging it as an asset. So when it goes down in price because interest rates are going up, you have to pledge more collateral. So where's that collateral going to come from if you don't have new savings and productive investment? That's the era we're entering right now. And then, of course, we'll have the governments forcing new kinds of systems or policy changes, I should say, such as, I'll use the expression, helicopter money, to push more money into our society. And that's when we start to get into hyperinflation. We're not there yet. We're still really finishing a deflationary cycle because of the globalization, which is starting to peak. When I say peak, the rate of growth is starting to peak. And then once we get into that fiat currency beginning to fail, we have the social strife, and then we get the forced changes into these institutions, forms of government I was mentioning earlier. Didn't mean to be long-winded there, Richard, because there's a lot in that, and we lay that out in the paper.
Oh, that's great. A lot. There's a lot going on. On the next slide, you mentioned where we are. We are here, and that appears to be past the Minsky moment. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, Richard, governments are not going to roll over and quit on us. And I'm not about to say that the markets are about to plummet, because what governments are very good at doing is changing the rules. And when they change the rules, they allow things to accelerate. And, I can give you all sorts of examples of that. But remember during the last financial crisis at the bottom of it, we had a concept called mark to market. Remember that?
Yeah.
And that was that all the books were so full of derivatives that they had to price them in a way that priced them to market. But to save the economy, besides all of the 13 facilities that the bank came out with, the regulators changed it where they didn't have to mark to market.
Yeah, right, exactly.
But they marked to fantasy.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And all of a sudden the bottom was in and the stock market took off and it's been running ever since. Not because of that, but it's an example, and only an example I'm trying to make, of how they changed the rules. They could have never changed that rule if the crisis hadn't hit. But we do that. And so every time we get into a problem, we change the regulations or we change something else. And right now, even if the markets start to fall, we have such a huge entitlement program. I think we're at least in the United States $10 trillion underfunded in total pensions at all levels. You can't have that kind of collapse. So it says you've got to keep the equities up. So as you and I both know, the Bank of Japan is already buying equities. It owns 5% of the Nikkei. It owns north of 70% of all ETFs. Then the Swiss National Bank buys, what, $65 billion, almost every quarter. That we know about. A lot of the central banks, Norwegian government has been buying. So they're buying equities already. Apparently the Fed is not, and the ECB is not, and the Bank of England is not. But if we get into a crisis, you can expect them to start buying equities in some fashion or shape. I'm not saying that's definitely going to happen. I'm just trying to give you an example that this is not over. They have not ran out of tricks that they will bring forward to keep this thing going and into this Minsky melt-up. But it goes back to that cycle we were just talking, Richard. You can't keep doing it unless there's collateral somewhere. And there's just not enough unpledged collateral out there right now. Unless they just print the money, and then what happens is if you print it without collateral, called helicopter money, that's the basic derivative of helicopter money, then in fact you get immediately hyperinflation. That's this year, in 2018, 2019, I don't know. But I do know, Richard, that over the next 3 years, this big reversal that we talk about in the paper, and we can talk about it if you want, is going to unfold and is going to take away all the options from the governments.
Yeah, yeah.
Have fiat currencies.
Can you elaborate on that, on how you see that happening and the reversal, what that is?
Yeah, absolutely, Richard. The bottom line, and it's not my concept. This was actually a paper put out by the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, the central bank.
Mm-hmm, yes.
And they were very clear. It's the most important paper they put out in years. And they were warning the central banks to say, look, you've got to get off this printing of the money, and you've got to start normalizing, and you've got to do it now. And they have begun to do it. Whether aggressive or not. And because what they're saying and what they argue is the issue is that demographics, which are changing dramatically, baby boomers don't buy as much. The millennials have not got as much money at least in the United States, but around the world, even in China, where we've had a dramatic reduction in the growth of the population, we don't have the youth that's coming on in relationship with the accumulation of wealth that the previous generations have had. So what we're seeing is that the rate of savings, and savings goes back to, as I said earlier, this building of collateral and underpinning debt and the rollover of the debt, is growing, but at a certain rate, which is a much slower rate. But it's slower than the investment capital that's needed to sustain the debt levels and the growth levels we have right now. And that difference is growing at a significant rate. And that is going to force, because it's a supply and demand, it's going to force yields to rise steadily, and I not necessarily in a big spike, but consistently. So as yields go up, it lowers the collateral values of the bonds. And as we were saying earlier, before we began the show, Richard, the global swaps marketplace is over $600 trillion, and at least $400 trillion of that's in bonds. So a 1%, 2% increase in rates is just a staggering reduction in the collateral value, which has to be shored up. It's like a giant margin call for those who've had a margin call, you know that's not a very good day.
Yeah.
So that's the problem, and it's like a glacier. It's coming. You can't stop this. We can't create the babies and the people to do it. And now we've got so much leverage in the system. We're so highly leveraged. So they'll try and stop it. They're using pension plans, buying the markets, printing the money to do it, and that's what will eventually lead to a fiat currency failure. So I hope I explained that easily, Richard.
Yes, quite interesting.
It's a 70-page paper. I tried to do it in less than 70 words.
Yeah, exactly. And the pension crisis, how do you see that unfolding? What will pension funds be doing given this view that you see unfolding?
Well, I think the pension plans right now are in the middle of a lot of changes that they know they have to do. I think they see a large amount of this pretty clearly, at least the better ones. And they're moving they've been moving out of the stock market. So I think they see a bigger run up. But they're moving into private equities, out of exchange traded. I don't mean ETF, but exchange traded products. Because they're not looking for liquidity. They're looking for long-term investments. They're doing that. I think they're also accounting on the government to come in and start to guarantee investments. I think you'll see the government's guaranteeing pension plans, payouts on it, even if it's with fiat currencies. And I think they're speculating that the major banks will, in fact, or the major central banks will enter into buying the equity markets. And if that's the case, they will stay in and start going heavily into the equity markets. I don't think they've bought into that quite yet. I have. I believe that's where the central banks are pointed.
Mm-hmm. And so
they have. I mean, there was a paper out. We have $400 trillion in pensions around the world globally, all totaled. And right now in the United States, we have an $84 trillion underfunded pension entitlement underfunded. Where's that money going to come from, right, Richard?
Yeah, exactly.
They just can't print it. They've got to make sure that it's created through the financial markets, and a big part of that is either in the debt market, bonds, or in the equities. And I hear consistently, I get a little off track here, Richard, but it is an important point that, you know, right now as we talk here today, they're talking about funding the government's debt and another CR, getting it forward. And, you know, we got a $20 trillion thereabouts U.S. federal debt and, you know, the tax plan and what it's going to do, how it's going to increase it. But, you know, we're squabbling over nothing because the United States debt is not $20 trillion. It's $84 trillion. Because of the unfunded liabilities associated with Medicare, Medicaid, and other social programs that we made commitments to that are coming due, because we have 10,000 baby boomers a day retiring, and we'll have a million a month turning 70. A million a year. I apologize. In 1970, are turning 70 years old here next year. So the rate at which they're now claiming and the number of people who don't have the money to pay into it, the youth, is significant out of line. But as bad as that is, that's still not our debt, Richard. The debt, and this is why this cycle is going to unfold, because our debt is actually $220 trillion. And you say, well, Gord, how did you come to that number? That's called the fiscal gap. And what the fiscal gap is, we've had Kutlikoff a couple times, and he's laid it out. He's been before Congress. They know it. And what the fiscal gap is let's say we lend money to Puerto Rico. The U.S. government doesn't lend money to Puerto Rico. The banks do. What we do is we guarantee it, and we guarantee it in what is called in accounting lingo a contingent liability. So the banks lend the money. Puerto Rico pays the banks, and by the way, they couldn't pay 6%, went bankrupt, but now the banks want 12 or 14% because they're not worried about it. They gouge them because they know if they default, we're going to ante.
Yeah.
So we pay if, in fact, somebody goes broke. Well, we have got $220 trillion because we've been bankrolling everybody in the world with, you know, we call it aid, right? Government aid for whatever country. And we have these contingent liabilities. Let's say the U.S. economy actually suffered a recession or a slowdown. And let's just say at 2%, defaulted. Now we're talking close to $5 trillion on $25 trillion. We can't another. Am I making sense here, Richard?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And I haven't got, and I forget the entitlements which were coming due on that $84 trillion.
Right. So
that's why this is a given. The question is just the timing of it. And that's why we're going to see a new world order. Because out of this crisis, it's not all bad news. Out of this crisis is a natural set of changes that need to happen. And there's a better world on the other side of it.
And so given this view, potential unfolding, as you've indicated, what are your thoughts on the financial markets, short-term, medium-term, long-term, and the investment markets in general, not just financial markets? How do you see that unfolding for the various asset classes like commodities, equities, bonds, currencies?
Well, it really gets down to what you price it in, and that is the U.S. dollar. Because, you know, gold can be going up or down depending on what's going on with the U.S. dollar, right?
Yeah.
So it's really what's going to happen in the shorter term I'm talking about here is what kind of strength we're going to see. Are we going to see weakness in the U.S. dollar? And a big part of what you see with the U.S. dollar is often it's a flight to safety. So if we have geopolitical problems, people tend to flight. We're the least ugly at the party, if you would, so that money will flow to the U.S. dollar, which strengthens the U.S. dollar, which has a certain behavior in the asset markets. So that we're facing such significant numbers, and that was that opening slide of tipping points right now, of which one of those might create the shock that impacts the U.S. dollar and the various crosses right now. Because the moment we have this, what happens is Japan takes home their money into the yen because it's been a safe currency for them, even despite the debasement of it. And then the carry trade starts to contract. So that's what you need to watch. You need to watch what's going to happen with the dollar. I personally think we're going to have some pretty significant frights in the next 6 months in the financial markets. And because we're at such levels, it's only normal. It's natural. We haven't had a 5% correction in historical lengths of time. You know, 15%, 20%, perfectly normal in a market. That the leverage couldn't handle that right now. But so as we see some of these normal adjustments in the market, it's going to be how we react to them. And whether the policies that I was alluding to earlier forces the central banks to reverse course of normalization and taper, whether it forces them to put into things such as helicopter money, time will tell. But these crises are going to happen. It depends how people will react in the market. But, Richard, I'm not sure that this is the time you want to be speculating in the markets. That last 5, 10% can often be the most expensive.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of places, and I'm just simply saying there's a lot of places to invest right now besides the stock and the bond market.
Yeah, what would be your suggestions for investors, generically in terms of asset classes? Where can they protect themselves? Where can they get yield?
The best place to is always to look at getting out, as I said, with the currencies. Get out of the currencies. Get into hard assets. Because real wealth, the real collateral we talked about here – is hard assets. Your money is something, you know, you can't grow, you have to grow it, you have to mine it, or you have to build it. And those are the hard assets. So put your money into those real substance, items. Gold and silver have always been the epitome of a hard assets, but to be frank, right now, they're a manipulated paper market. Right? I think that pretty evident, but that doesn't mean you don't have some level of those kinds of hard assets. There's a lot of various commodities. I know that there's ranges of look what's happening with cobalt, nickel, and lithium right now. I mean, there's no better performing hard assets than them. They're right off the charts. Why? Because of electric volts, cars. And it's not because I think there's going to be a lot of electric cars in Canada or in the United States, but because that's where they're going in China and India. I mean, there is no question. There's 50 new models coming out next year. And as you know, as a Canadian, Richard, you just have to go up to Cobalt, Ontario. They're blowing their lids going on off there. Now that game has already happened.
Okay.
But the point is that that's the kinds of areas that you need to continuously being looked into. And the reason they move is people say, hey, there's some real value here. I know gold, junior gold mining stocks have really started to move too. But it's not, I'm not saying to do that. I'm just trying to say it's these look for hard assets.
Yeah. And you mentioned also private equity as a potential.
For those who can participate in private equity. Typically in the United States, you have to be an accredited investor, so you're limited in whether you can do that. But I do know there were new laws changed in Canada that allow you to have a certain percentage in private equity. And if you do your research properly, now they're not as liquid, they're longer term, but you know, sometimes in a crisis, you're just glad to have your money in a safe place.
Yeah. And perhaps to end our discussion today, we can go to your last slide on what all politicians can be expected to do, a quote from U.S. President Donald Trump.
Well, I put up him just to say he's just like all the rest. No matter what, they're going to print the money, Richard.
Yeah.
It's the only, and it's not because they're bad people. It's the only solution they can agree on anything because it's not their money.
Yeah.
And Trump was quite clear before he became president. He says, we can't go broke. We can print the money.
Right.
And he said he was the biggest, you know, he was the king of debt.
Yeah.
And I'm not picking on Trump in the least in my comments.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to say, you know, he would probably be, and he's a right-wing conservative, right? And he believes that this is the solution. So you can bet that as these events unfold, and they will unfold, that's the tact that they'll take. And once you know that, investing becomes relatively easy. Because once you understand the policies that the government's likely to take, your investment becomes a little easier, or what to stay away from.
Well, great insight as always, Gore. This has been a fascinating discussion. We'll put up those slides. And how can our listeners learn more about your work?
Well, right now, Richard, I pretty well restricted to my work because I am retired. I'm an investor. I just manage my own money right now. But I do this kind of work really to really narrow in on where my investing should be. But I publish and put all of this at mattasii.com. And there's a subscription service for it, depending on what kind of detail you want to go down to. But a lot of it's right out on a public page. That's mattasii.com, and you can sign up. And if you sign up on the newsletter, we'll send you the very thesis. There's a whole list of things that we'll send you if you're interested.
Well, great. Thank you very much, Gord, for being on the show. It'd be great to do it in the near future again.
Talk to you again then, Richard.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only, and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.